Number 242734, United States versus Cubillas.
Thank you.
Welcome back and thank you for double duty today.
Mr. Roldan did not receive a fair trial. He testified that he was pretending to be a drug dealer, but believed that he was helping his police partner, Aguas, seize drugs. Nonetheless, the district court, excluded evidence that Aguas had actually seized drugs twice during the exact same time period as the charged crime. Mr. Roldan also testified that he believed Aguas would pay him by skimming money from the top of a reward. But the court excluded evidence that Aguas had done that before. These pieces of-
Can you point me to where in the record that exclusion is, the skimming piece?
It's in the same motion in limine as the motion in limine related to the two seizures. The district court rules against them both without any reason, just saying for the reasons stated by the government with respect to both of those matters. Both of those exclusions would have bolstered Mr. Roldan's testimony and supported his state of mind defense.
Could you talk to us, please, about Aguas's two innocent actions during the relevant time period in those few months? Because it seemed to me that it was your client's knowledge of them, not the fact that he may have taken those actions in that period, that was relevant to his own reasonable belief that that's what he was doing, that he was helping effect a seizure on behalf of the government from which he would get a small amount of skimmed off the top reward. And I didn't see that. I saw more the focus on whether Aguas had himself done those two actions and assisted in those seizures in that time frame.
Mr. Roldan testified that he knew that Aguas had done drug seizures before. So the fact that that was true would have made it more credible that Mr. Roldan believed Aguas when Aguas told him that. With respect to them being innocent actions by Aguas, I don't think that's a fair characterization. The government calls them prior good acts, but that's not true. It's really prior kind of mildly bad acts in that it's sort of mild police corruption. He was doing drug seizures, but not following the specific by-the-book process that he was supposed to do, skimming money from the top. So this is classic other act evidence of under 404B that goes directly to Mr. Roldan's intent.
How would it have made a difference, I guess? I mean, you said I think it would support his testimony, but he did testify. There was the admission of the other seizure and the testimony from Major Torres, right? And that seems to get to the same thing, doesn't it? So would it have mattered, I guess, is the question.
Yes, Your Honor, because this whole case was about that crucial issue of intent. Having Mr. Roldan testify is one thing, but having evidence come in through through the government's case, they didn't dispute that these seizures had happened, adds a great deal of credibility to what Mr. Roldan says later. It's different in type. Especially also because it would have.
My point is that has to be in light of that there is already some evidence that there was other evidence from Major Torres and about Aguas's involvement in seizures.
There's a stipulation because Major Torres was unavailable after the government had spoken to that police department, just saying that Aguas had attempted to do a drug seizure that hadn't worked out. So these other two are a bit different in that they were successful. And that he had done successful seizures would have also allowed the defense to undermine the Attorney General's testimony, where the Attorney General details at length that Aguas has never, is nowhere in the records as having conducted lawful drug seizures operations. Having these prior seizures in evidence would have allowed the defense to effectively undermine that testimony. Instead, that testimony stood unopposed, essentially, and then the government gets up on summation and points to the fact that the records were scoured and there was no evidence of Aguas having participated in this kind of thing before. So the summation only bolstered the error, and made it so the jury only had Mr. Roldan's testimony to rely on. Here, also because the district court essentially gave no reasoning, I would urge the court to use a more relaxed abuse of discretion standard in that we don't know what the district court really believed was the reason to exclude this evidence. The court doesn't explain. It's relevant. It was extremely relevant to the defense and would have provided crucial support for the defense. This error in the evidence is also compounded by the jury charge error, which is about the exact same issue of intent. So the defense asks for a jury charge issue that is legally correct and would have bolstered their defense, would have supported their theory of defense, that government informants cannot participate in the conspiracy because they lack the intent.
Was that important to include? I mean, that was not what was... what was going on? He either had the intent to participate in a conspiracy that involved importation of the 1,000 kilos, or he had some lesser intent maybe to participate in something that would enable him to take some cash home, but much more minor, right?
Right.
So why was it so critical to say, restate the basic proposition that an informant can't participate in an illegal conspiracy?
Well, the problem was even the court didn't understand that the informants couldn't participate because they lacked intent. The defense was making the exact same argument about Mr. Roldan, that he too lacked the intent. And as provided, the jury could have thought, okay, official government informants can't be part of a conspiracy, but because Mr. Roldan wasn't part of he wasn't an official government informant, he still could be guilty, even if he believed he was working for the police.
I thought the district court explained to the jury the defense theory that he wasn't a part of the conspiracy because he would intend something different. And he had also given the correct instruction that to be a member of a conspiracy, you have to have the intent to join its aims.
Yes, Your Honor, but the district court did not, in providing the elements, talk about intent with respect to forming the conspiracy and why the informants couldn't have that intent. That is lacking, and it does not appear anywhere else in the charge. Moving to the sentencing here, the court did not calculate the guidelines before imposing sentence. That is a procedural error. The Supreme Court has made clear repeatedly that is a procedural error, and that the guidelines are the starting point and the framework for sentencing. So that is an error that this court really should reverse on.
So the court didn't recalculate the guidelines, and it did make a clear ruling that you've challenged on the mitigating role adjustment. It sent mixed signals and initially said, I'm taking the PSR recommendation, but then later specifically said, I'm not using the abuse of trust and the obstruction of justice. Is it your view that are you seeking to send it back for resentencing, holding the court to its second finding on abuse of trust and obstruction, just so that the anchor guideline is different, or are those open for relitigation at this point, since it wasn't clear whether and how the court ruled?
I'm asking the court to vacate the sentence and send it back for resentencing with a guideline calculation. I have no reason to think the judge would change the rulings that he had made sentencing.
He made mixed rulings. I guess I'm partly, this is a be careful what you wish for situation, but I guess that's neither here nor there. If you lose in the mitigating role adjustment, and you win on the others, you're still looking at a guideline that's quite a bit higher than the actual sentence. But I take it your point is, but the court will have thought it varied from the guidelines range more than it actually did, and it needs to know that because of it intended to, is that the theory?
Yes, Your Honor, and also that probation may have provided a different recommendation if probation knew the guideline range was lower. So everything was anchored to the PSR range, and then the court started its review. The court actually it wasn't just unclear. First, it said it adopted the PSR range. Then it said that it wasn't adopting the obstruction enhancement, but didn't mention the abuse of trust. And then only after sentencing at the government's prompting did it say that it hadn't adopted either. And then the government provides the guidelines, which the court just says yes to. And there's a specific and extremely clear objection by defense counsel citing the relevant case law that the guidelines need to be calculated before sentencing, because otherwise the guideline, they can have no impact if they're not calculated until afterward. There's really no reason not to vacate for that procedural error. The government points to the standard in Molina-Martinez about reversal for plain error, and this is not a plain error situation as it is preserved. And even under the plain error standard, Molina-Martinez says most cases where there's the procedural error require a vacatur and a remand.
So the government also suggests that this is kind of a fluid thing, and that the, given how things unfolded here for sentencing, that if we vacated and remanded, we'd expect the exact same sentence to be imposed and the district court to decline to apply the couple of enhancements that had been proposed and end up with the same. And I had the sense in my review that this was a kind of fluid thinking out loud, but he had considered these, and he's a very experienced district court judge, obviously, and had thought that the initial guidelines was just too high, and that given his inability to carry out the alleged conspiracy and his patent inability to carry it out, as a police officer, that the abuse of respect and other enhancements were inappropriate to apply. So do you really expect that we'd have a different result on vacatur and remand? Didn't the district court take this all into account already?
So we don't have that type of record, Your Honor. And that the court doesn't have to see into the future to find that a remand is appropriate. Even on records where the district court is much clearer that the sentence would be the same regardless of how they ruled on the guideline, this court routinely reverses, just as Supreme Court precedent tells you to do. For example, in Seabrook and the line of cases cited in my brief. Here we don't have that. All we have is the government at the very end of the proceeding saying, would your sentence be the same? And the court saying yes. That's not something that doesn't come close to the statements that were made in those other cases. And the other portion is we do not have a detailed 3553A discussion by the court in this case. It's very limited. And that's one of the factors that Molina-Martinez discusses as well. One, the court has gone into a very detailed discussion about the 3553A factors. That might be a more unusual case where reversal wouldn't be required. Again, in the plain error context, so we're in a better position than that. Here, the court gives a very brief discussion talking about how he believed Mr. Roldan was a good person, a good family man, and just that he didn't believe his testimony. It's exceedingly brief, and vacatur should be granted by this court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
For a few minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alexander Lee. I represent the United States of America in this appeal, as I did before the district court. I'd like to just start with some of the questions the court has asked, and I'll begin with the one I think Judge Robinson started with, which is whether there was any evidence Aguas had personally skimmed money from an informant. There was no evidence. And I would point the court to docket 181. That's one of the pretrial motion papers at pages 16 through 17. And there, the defense counsel actually articulates exactly what their argument is and what the basis is for it. And what they say is, what they want to put in is evidence that, quote, officers in the anti-narcotics unit with which Aguas was working, and that's what we call Region 8, quote, profited financially from their sources' monetary rewards. So in other words, the evidence at issue was not that Aguas had personally skimmed anything from an informant. It's that a colleague of Aguas at this base had skimmed money. So that's the evidence.
So let me ask, because that sort of flows into one of the things I've been sort of puzzling about. The testimony from the defendant here is that Aguas told him, I work at an anti-narcotics base. I have a source who gives me information. I give that information to the bosses. They speak with the DEA, and we all work together, and we carry out the seizure. And then they pay a reward, and I skim some. So he tells them that story. If the jury believes that, that would be very persuasive evidence that the government hadn't met its burden to show that this defendant intended to participate in international drug trafficking as opposed to some sort of unethical skimming of the police department. So that's a really important piece there as to whether the jury believes that Agua actually told defendant that and defendant believed it. Wouldn't evidence that Agua had actually reported in the same time period multiple seizures, two seizures that led to an apprehension, wouldn't that make the defendant's testimony that this is what he told me more credible?
I take the court's point, but I think the answer is no, and here's
why. Why not?
So it's undisputed that some of the things that Agua's told Rodon were lies. So, for example, Agua's claimed that he was already working with the DEA on the seizure that he was purportedly recruiting Rodon into. And that was false, because you'll recall, just looking at the timeline alone, right, the first meetings with the real confidential informant happened in May of 2021, but Agua's and his informant don't meet with the DEA until the end of June 2021. So it certainly was not true that in May of 2021, when Agua's and Rodon meet with the DEA's real confidential informant, that Agua's had already been working with the DEA. That was a false statement that he purportedly made to Rodon. And so and I should also note that the defense counsel himself, in closing summations, said that, well, I don't really know if Agua's is telling the truth or not. Maybe he was a scammer. In other words, maybe Agua's was lying, maybe he wasn't. So I think what that tells you, Your Honor, is Agua's sometimes did lie. And so if he sometimes lies and he sometimes tells the truth, then whether he actually, in fact, worked on prior seizures or not doesn't make it more likely that he's telling the truth on a particular occasion.
No, but I think I'm making a slightly different point. I don't think I'm making the point that it makes it more likely that Agua was telling the truth. I think it makes it more likely that Agua, in fact, told the story to the defendant that the defendant says he told me. He told me that this is how it works, and there's seizures, and then I skip. If, in fact, we know that the major says, oh, yeah, apparently he called to me because he's called a couple times before and reported seizures, that seems to me to reinforce the inference that, truthfully or not, Agua did, in fact, say that to defendant. Because the jury had to have disbelieved. The jury had to have either concluded that Agua didn't really say that to the defendant or that it was so obviously not credible that that's what was going on, that defendant harbored criminal intent, even though Agua told them that that's what they were doing.
I think I understand the court's point. I guess I would point to a couple things. You know, one, to the extent that sort of corroboration of the fact of the statement is really the purpose for which it's being offered, that wasn't the argument that was made. The argument that was made before the district court was that this is 404B evidence that goes to Agua's intent, which then somehow sheds light on Rodon's intent. And if it really is about Agua's intent, then that's a propensity argument. What that really is to show that Agua's really intent truly was to effect a seizure, not to send the drugs to the United States, and then that Rodon, the defendant, shared that same legitimate intent. So the argument that was made before the district court was not that this was going to be used in some sort of corroborative sense of corroborating a statement purportedly made to Rodon, but rather as 404B evidence. And that's what we were responding to. And I think,
I mean, we don't exactly know what the court's rationale was, but I guess we assume it was whatever the government argued.
Well, what the government argued was, in response to this 404B argument, is that, no, this is propensity evidence. This is prior good act evidence. Why this is propensity?
Well, it's not prior good act. It's prior some act, right? I mean, when I think about the case where there was evidence that these co-conspirators, or I forget the name, is old.
Abu Jalam, I think.
Yeah, you know where I'm going there, right?
Yes.
Where there was evidence that they had duped an innocent courier twice before. And this guy's defense was, I was an innocent courier. The fact that that was their MO, that they were duping, that was relevant, and it would have been inappropriate to exclude it because it was purporting to show an act in conformity with a prior practice. Why isn't this sort of the same? If for all we know, those prior seizures were set up exactly the same, right? He not only had a confidential informant, but he actually orchestrated the deal and then reported the seizure.
So I think it's dissimilar for two reasons. So the first reason is that unlike the Dubin case, where the MO was really the same, so in that case, the defendant's cousins duped some third party, and then the defendant said, my cousins duped me in exactly the same way. Here we're talking about a very, very different set of facts. So what Aguas did was he worked on two legitimate seizures where he had a legitimate civilian informant who was involved. The DEA paid the informant, and the Colombian National Police made the seizures. There is no suggestion that Aguas personally was involved as an undercover in those operations, nor, by the way, was there any evidence that Roldan had any personal knowledge or involvement in those whatsoever. And I think this is important because one argument that the defense has made and before this court is that the government somehow misled the jury by offering evidence from the Colombian Attorney General's office that neither Roldan nor Aguas had ever worked on undercover operations. What I just said, that neither Roldan nor Aguas worked on operations, undercover operations, was the evidence, and that was true.
No, it was true, but I think the argument is, you're describing a sort of, I would describe maybe as a legalistic distinction between, did Agua participate before as a sanctioned undercover officer in setting up a sting operation, versus has he in the past helped facilitate seizures of drugs, and not even in the past, but during this same period. And from the jury's perspective, I don't know whether the nicety of a formal sting operation versus trying to set it up so that you can report the seizure is going to be as significant. It would be significant as to whether he's corrupt vis-a-vis his own police force. But the jury didn't get to hear. They hear, oh, there's no record of anything, but they don't get to hear that in this same time period, Agua was reporting drugs that lead to seizures.
Well, I guess I would say two things.
If I could just follow up, and that would bear on whether the strength of Roldan's testimony that Agua told him that he was doing that, and that was really Roldan's purpose in participating. Is that right, Judge Robinson? So that's what I was taking from this. That it doesn't really have to do with Aguas's own intent quite so much as it bears directly on Roldan, whether it fortifies Roldan's testimony.
Right. I mean, that's the question I asked before. Yeah. I was juxtaposing it in this follow-up with this other argument that was both presented to the jury in evidence and argued, and it felt like it created a little bit of a heads I win, tails you lose situation.
Sure. So I don't think it did that. And let me just address the point first, Judge Carney, and then I'll come back to the question Judge Robinson raised. So Judge Carney, to answer your question, right, this is abuse of discretion review. And had the defense argued that this evidence regarding Aguas's prior seizures would somehow serve this corroborative role as to what Aguas told Roldan, then we might be in a different situation. But that's not what they argued. What they argued is that this is 404B evidence, that it goes to Roldan's intent because it somehow goes, well, excuse me.
Well, it goes to what Roldan believed that he was participating in. It was my understanding.
Well, what they argued was that it shows Aguas's capability and intent, and that bared on Roldan's intent. And I think the only inference you can draw from that is that it bared on Aguas' intent and capability because he really had such a plan.
Well, so you
and
have
therefore,
to build
Roldan
an
joined
extra
it.
Step, which the district court said was attenuated, but I mean that's different from saying that's not the argument they raised. It's just there's a bit of speculation.
The argument certainly was not clearly presented to the district judge that this formed some sort of corroborative function to Aguas actually telling Roldan that he had such a plan. What they argued was that it showed Aguas, in fact, had the capability and the intent. And the danger to that is that it presents to this jury this fact, which was that Aguas had, in fact, this plan to conduct this undercover seizure that would go unrebutted by the fact that Aguas had pled guilty weeks before, disclaiming such an intent, right? So that's the real danger to this evidence, and that's why the district court properly precluded it, because under a 404B analysis, there's an integrated 403 problem, right? The evidence has to be not substantially more prejudicial than probative. And this inference that the jury would have received that, oh, Aguas was really up to some sort of good operation, is an argument that the government could not have rebutted and would have been exceedingly misleading to the jury.
Thank you. I'm sorry I've turned you off track from responding to Judge Robinson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just to respond directly to your point, there was evidence already presented to the jury that Aguas had was purporting to work with a civilian informant and that had this plan. And that was in the form of Major Torres Valero's stipulation.
Right.
That, in fact, Aguas had brought such a informant to Major Torres Valero. Major Torres Valero then organized a meeting with the DA. And there's also testimony from a DA agent who was present at that meeting. And what the undisputed evidence showed was that at the meeting, the informant provided no information about any operation and didn't even provide his name. It was a 5-minute meeting. And so if Aguas really was planning to do some sort of secret sting operation, then surely at this meeting, when he had that opportunity to present that information to the DEA, he would have done that. That's not what happened. Instead, what happened was Aguas took the information, meaning that he found the location where the DA was meeting people, and then he went to the co-conspirators and he went to the real DA informant and said, I don't ever want to meet there again. That's where the DEA holds meetings. So I think the evidence that the court's concerned about, the evidence that perhaps Aguas really told Roldan this because Aguas was in fact doing something like this, that information was presented to the jury. And so
it was vis-a-vis this particular, that he did go to, it was all part of the same meeting and it was like two paragraphs down in the notes, right? That he did report this expected potential seizure at the airport and that he then talked to the DEA about it and that they rejected it. But it seems to me that that plays into the narrative of the defendant believing that he was participating in a sanctioned formal sting operation, and it kind of knocks the legs out from under that. But I think that the notion that he's trying to not as a sanctioned undercover operation, but as a way to set up a skim opportunity, he's setting up a drug transaction so that Agua can then report it. I mean, the fact of prior reports that are corroborated and did actually lead to successful seizures seems to me, again, not to reinforce that that was Agua's intent, but reinforce that's something Agua told him, because it makes sense that Agua would have told him that.
Yeah, again, I just emphasize that we are on abuse of discretion review, and had this argument been squarely presented to the district court, you know, we would have had an opportunity to address it in a different form. But even taking that argument at face value, Your Honor, I think at best it's cumulative of the evidence that was in fact presented, including the fact that Aguas in fact had this meeting with the DEA. In fact, he did bring an informant to that meeting. And of course, the facts of what happened at that meeting were presented to the jury.
Could you talk, and I don't want to like hijack, but I do want to hear a little bit about the sentencing, because we do sort of talk about how the role of the sentence guidelines as an anchor, and even if you're above guidelines or below guidelines, understanding where the guideline range really is an important factor in making sure that the court knows sort of how far it's varying. You're not disputing that the court didn't actually determine a guidelines range before sentencing here, or are you?
I think the court did determine it. Of course,
did it say here's what the range is?
Well, I said what the range was, and the court agreed that was in fact the range. And the court, I also asked the court whether it affected the court's determination of the sentence, and the court said it did not.
That was after the sentence. You're talking about
at the conclusion of the sentencing.
Yeah,
so the sentencing conclusion had. The sentencing proceeding had not completed. So my point is that the court did, in fact, ultimately determine the guidelines range, and it had an opportunity to say, actually, based on this guidelines range, I'm going to make an alteration, and the court emphatically did not. And I think what that tells Your Honor is that, yes, in the most cases, I think the Supreme Court has said in 80% of cases, absent a government motion, you get a guidelines sentence. And that's how you know the guidelines are really important and are the anchor and should serve as the anchor. Absolutely. But this is not that case. Whether the guidelines is life imprisonment, as the PSR said, or whether it's 292 to 365, as was correctly calculated at the end, what Judge Kaplan did was he imposed something way, way below, 165. And you know this from the record because Judge Kaplan engaged in a colloquy with defense counsel and said, you have to go 9 levels below to even get you to 180, the probation's recommendation, being a guideline sentence. And so that's how you know that, and this is the unusual case where the guidelines did not serve that anchoring function and where there really is no purpose served by asking Judge Kaplan to recite again what the correct calculation was, which, again, he did, in fact, do at the end of the proceeding. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll respectfully rest on our submission. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal.
Judge Robinson has it exactly correct in saying that the fact of the prior reports and seizures by Aguas would have assisted the defense and made the jury view, or likely made the jury view, Mr. Roldan's testimony differently. That is especially true because this was an extremely unusual and confusing case where many parties were pretending to be somebody they weren't. We know at least 4 of the people were working for the government, so were lying in what they were saying. We know that the cooperating witness also said that she was lying at various points. And then the question is what Mr. Roldan believed. When you have such a confusing case specifically about people's intent, excluding this concrete evidence that would have supported the defense testimony and the defense theory was error.
So what the government has told us that is not how the argument was presented below, and we're on abuse of discretion review, so can you help clarify that?
Yes, I don't think that's a fair characterization. It's true that the specific testimony, hadn't occurred yet, so the argument about the exclusion occurred in a motion in limine stage, but the defense explained that it was relevant to intent. And I think it was either Judge Carney or Judge Robinson that noted that whether it's the intent of Aguas and then the intent of Roldan or goes directly to Roldan doesn't really matter.
Why doesn't it, though? I mean, that seems important, whose intent it is. Because otherwise you have to add that it's somewhat speculative, inference that if it was as to Aguas, that then he probably would have told that to Roldan.
No, it's about whether whether Mr. Roldan credibly, whether it makes sense that he believed Aguas when Aguas told him that he participated in seizures. The fact that Aguas, in fact, did participate in seizures was extremely important information. The reason that we're all unsure why the district court excluded this is also just because the district court didn't give any explanation. So that's why we're left with these question marks. But that shouldn't be a problem for the defense. Rather, that should be more of a reason why the court should send it back. With respect to the sentencing, the government just argued, essentially, I think, that because it was a below-guideline sentence, that's an exception where the fact that no guideline was calculated shouldn't be a procedural error requiring remand. I have seen no case that supports that. The government hasn't cited any cases that support that. When the Supreme Court talks about the unusual case where remand isn't required, they are talking about a case where the 3553A factors are discussed at length, and so it's very clear from the record how the court reached its decision. And again, that's in the plain error context. So we don't have that here, and I think it would be a dramatically new case law to say that any time somebody gets a below-guideline sentence, it's okay.
Well, it's not just any time. Didn't the district court say that he would need a 9-point reduction for his guidelines range to fall below the 180-month sentence that probation recommended? And so we're talking something, a dramatic disparity, right?
That's true. And then the court went slightly below probation. And counsel, during that earlier discussion, correctly pointed out that if probation had had the correct guideline range, which the government now agrees, they said it's the correct guideline range, they may too have had a lower recommendation, which then may have had a different impact from the district court. The point is we don't know because the district court didn't calculate it. And that's why a remand is required.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. We'll take the case under advisement. The last argument on the calendar for today is in case number 25480, MG versus Rye City School District.
Thank you. Hello, Your Honors. I'm proceeding pro se today. I'm not an attorney. I'm simply a parent of children with severe disabilities. The lower court erred in dismissing our IDA case without reaching any of the merits. It treated the service as it was due, even though the district designated the due date a legal holiday, closed his offices, and then made service impossible. It also dismissed the case for jurisdiction, even though we had already exhausted all the administrative remedies. So the service deadline was extended under 279.11b regulation, which says when service is impossible, the deadline date just automatically extends to the next business day. It doesn't require early service, and it doesn't require parents to do what's impossible. The district's own calendar on that date said that Memorial Day, no school. Very many times the schools close, but the offices are open. And that's what happened on that day. And so service was, in fact, timely.
I understand that after the SRO, State Review Officer, dismissed your request, your attorney then sent a letter arguing that May 26th was a legal holiday and asking for reconsideration.
Yes.
But that was the first time that your attorney argued that there was a legal holiday. And I was kind of curious that it didn't happen till well after the dismissal. There seemed to be just a gap. Was there something else going on that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honors. I believe that he did actually, in fact, tell the SRO that. And then the SRO said that there was nothing that they could do.
This was after the SRO had already ruled. So when it was filed on the Tuesday, it didn't come with it. Not that he had to show good cause, because he didn't believe it was, he had to, but that this was, under the regulations, a timely filing, is what he was saying, I think. But he didn't say that until well after the SRO had dismissed it, and there are constraints on what the state review officer could do at that point.
Right. It was a few days afterwards, Your Honor. And so that's when it was uncovered that it was, in fact, dismissed. And that's when he asked for re-argument and, you know, reconsideration, but didn't, did not get that. He said he couldn't do anything, so therefore that's when the SRO told us we needed to go to, you know, the district court, which is precisely what we did. So in addition, the district itself had designated it a legal holiday, and there's really no regulation that defines what a legal holiday is. And the courts
Did it designate a legal holiday or did it just say we're going to be closed on Friday?
They designated a legal holiday according to their documentation. It said Memorial Day, no school. So, but there is no, like I said, in the law, there really is no standard of what a legal holiday is. A lot of the courts have found that closures around holidays, snow days, emergency days, are qualified as legal holidays for service extension purposes. So service, aside from the holiday issue, service was impossible. I went there myself on that Friday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to serve at the offices, and I was surprised to find that they were closed. Nobody told us it was closed. It wasn't in any of the documents. My attorney didn't know, so I contacted him right away and said, I can't serve this, and you know that's when the district court erred in the timeline. And that's when he confirmed, okay, it's on the website, it's a legal holiday, it just automatically triggers, and we will serve on Tuesday. Never did we expect that this problem, which was actually caused by the district. So the district unilaterally closed its offices, and then it made it impossible to serve. And then it relied on that closure to appeal that the argument was not, you know, that it was, the appeal was untimely. So you, I think the courts are pretty clear in that, that you can't block service and then turn around and say, you know, and then use it against us. I think that there's many laws that say that's not allowed. It's also not allowed to cut off our time to appeal, because that would have, I haven't seen anything that says, yes, you have to serve early. And so there's no, those two things are where I believe the court erred.
Well, the district court noted that under New York law, there are actually other ways to serve school districts through board members or the superintendent. And I don't know if your attorney at the time was aware of that, but just because the office, the administrative office is closed does not necessarily mean that it's impossible.
It is under the education law, Your Honor, because of the privacy issue. So it's not a lawful alternative. So the lower court also erred presuming that we could serve somebody else, but the appeal papers actually contain quite a bit of PII, and that personally identifiable information is about a child with a disability. And that information is protected by IDA, it's protected by FERPA, it's protected by HIPAA. And so the service rules exist so parents can serve the office without exposing the confidential information to individual board members or the superintendent.
Why would the legal protections that come with that information not apply to whomever receives service, but to the only to the administrative folks?
Can you clarify the question? I apologize.
I understand what you're saying to be that there, because there's sensitive information in this filing, that it would have it had to go to the district administrative office as opposed to one of these other legal avenues for accomplishing service. And I guess I'm asking why that's the case.
Because when it closed its office, it eliminated the only lawful, privacy compliant way to serve. So nobody at the district office like knows who I am. I know several of the board members. They know who I am. I know the superintendent. Had I gone there, my identity, my child's identity with a disability needs to be shielded. And the law calls for that under the privacy laws. So that's a big issue. Never did I imagine that an issue that the district actually caused and closed their office would be used against us, because it was never really held on the merits. And that's all I really wanted. I wanted an appeal.
Thank you. You're reserved a minute for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The lower court in this proceeding issued a comprehensive, well-reasoned decision which thoroughly analyzed all of the issues that the plaintiffs have raised here. And the lower court determined that there was no basis to overturn the SRO decision because the plaintiffs failed to raise any of those issues before the state review officer. Specifically, the plaintiffs never argued to the SRO that the Friday before Memorial Day weekend should be considered a legal holiday under New York state law.
Well, they did. They did submit after the decision. They basically made a request for reconsideration and said, we understood this to be a legal holiday, and therefore our filing on the Tuesday was timely. They did after the fact, right?
They did after the fact, but the SRO does not, there's specific regulations in the Education Department that say there is no motion for reconsideration in SRO decisions.
Well, so they're put in kind of difficult position, aren't they? When they file on what they understood, when the office is closed, and they file on the first available day. The SRO makes a decision, but we are dealing with a federal statute at an intersection of federal and state law. It's not entirely clear to me that we need to defer to the SRO's finding of untimeliness when there seems to be a reason in the record to dispute whether a legal holiday includes the Friday before. It seems a very ungenerous interpretation of really important rights.
So I don't believe that that's true. I think if we're to accept the premise that the plaintiffs are offering, if we're accepting their interpretation of the law, then we're basically saying the Friday, May 26, 2023, is a legal holiday, but only for the purposes of serving the Rye City School District. It wouldn't be considered a legal holiday if the district was trying to serve the plaintiffs. It wouldn't be considered a legal holiday for any filings with the court. It wouldn't be considered a legal holiday for filing any other papers with any other person or entity in the state of New York.
But there are legal arguments to be made on both sides, aren't there, about what's a legal holiday, what's a public holiday? I mean, all courts in different systems and administrative agencies have different rules and understandings. We have a New York regulation here. I'm not sure we have to make quite so broad a ruling as you're suggesting.
So I would say, yes, there are different interpretations, and I think that the SRO's interpretation of its own rules should be given substantial deference.
Well, its own rules, but it is interpreting the federal, it's applying those rules with regard to the vindication of federal rights, right?
Absolutely, it certainly is.
Can I ask a question about does it matter for purposes of this question of whether the Friday is a legal holiday, whether the fact finder, let's say the SRO or the district court, depending on how you run it, relies on the calendar, the school district's calendar that specifically says Memorial Day weekend, no school on Friday the 26th, versus the document that the school district's offered that suggested it was a snow day makeup day?
It was a give back day, that's correct. It was not Memorial Day.
Okay,
we've got
mixed evidence on that, right? Yeah. We have a calendar are you challenging the authenticity of the school district calendar entry that was presented by MG?
I'm not contesting that.
Okay, so, and that's probably a document that parents would look at to figure out when there's holidays. It doesn't just say no school, it says Memorial Day weekend, no school. And there's no dispute that Memorial Day is a legal holiday.
Correct.
And some legal holidays, and Memorial Day is a little tougher, I agree, because we know Memorial Day is Monday, but you've got a lot of holidays where businesses close on other days as well. So I guess it's not as obvious to me that if we credit the district's own calendar, that this isn't essentially a closure incident to Memorial Day, which is a legal holiday.
But I think that the lower court properly addressed that issue in declining to extend the interpretation of the law to define a legal holiday as any day in which the school district is closed. And I think the court properly...
The legal holiday is Memorial Day.
Correct.
In the theory that I'm presenting. And the school district is observing Memorial Day on Friday, may also be observing it on Monday.
So I don't think that's accurate. The district is observing Memorial Day on Memorial Day, and if the district didn't have any additional snow days, it wouldn't have had that Friday off. That Friday is certainly a snow give-back day, and the fact that the district didn't use all of its snow days doesn't automatically convert that day to a holiday or a legal holiday under New York law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Setting aside the legal holiday, they caused it to be impermissible. I was there, ready to serve, had the documents. You can't block us and then file a dismissal. I mean, the reversal would not harm this district in any way, shape, or form, but it would harm us because we did the appeal, we did everything right, we followed things as I understood it, and it would really go against precedent that's established that says you don't cut off the time to appeal. That's a very well-known, I think, established principle of law. And then the other precedent, which basically says if a public entity makes it impossible, then what else were we supposed to do? They can't then use that against us. I think they unilaterally closed their offices, called it a holiday, cut off the time of appeal, and made service impossible. And the laws were really, under the IDEA, were intended to protect children with disabilities, not harm them. And I believe that we were not entitled those appeal rights. Those are required under the IDEA. We have the right to appeal, and that was taken away from us by a procedural default that was caused not by myself, but by the district itself. Therefore, I'm just simply being asked, please reverse this on the merits. Let us be heard at the district court. court level. It doesn't hurt them, it hurts us and all other children with disabilities.
Thank you both. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you so much.
The last case on the calendar for today, 25-303, United States versus Phelps, is on submission, so we will reserve decision in that case. And with that, I'll ask the courtroom deputy to adjourn.
Court stands adjourned.